I love the darkness just before dawn. Blue sky, so deep it's almost black. What stands out in the light of day is softened so that it almost disappears into the dark. And then the light begins to lift and dawn starts. And when I'm paying attention, when my reading lamp is out and my eyes are soft enough to see outside, I fancy I become a partner in creation as each new day begins. When I was younger, I liked to sleep in. But now I'm eager for the stillness and for the blessing just to be among those awake to greet the day. I haven't always been a morning person. I used to like to stay up late and sleep until the sun was high up in the sky. I even had an early teacher who was very important to me. I much admired him, who taught that what he called the waking dream was no more valuable than the dreams we dreamt at night. He was devoted to eliminating the difference between being asleep and being awake. He often dreamed the day away. In those days, so did I. But I also had another teacher, thank goodness, whose yoga practice included rising daily to salute the sun. Those of you who have studied Hatha Yoga are probably familiar with the asanas or postures of the salute. I'm not going to do the whole thing, but it starts here, and goes up, and back, and down, and I'm sure you all do it every day. It amounts to an embodied prayer, welcoming the rising sun and recognizing our complete dependence on its power. Now, I was raised close to the heart of a Unitarian church in the 50s, so I was steeped in the old Beacon curriculum. Does anybody remember the Beacon curriculum? Raise your hand if you remember the Beacon curriculum. All right, well, I'm going to have to give you a quick introduction then. I knew that Jesus was a carpenter's son. I knew that miracles, far from being rare, abound. And I knew that Unitarianism is an idea that rises up in every religious tradition, and that the idea is older than any particular faith, and certainly far older than our manifestation of the idea. Older than Islam, older than Christianity, older than Buddhism or Judaism, even though each of these faith traditions includes significant strands of Unitarian understanding in their concepts of God. The Beacon curriculum was based on the old strong stories. Stories so powerful and so deeply rooted that we wanted our children to know them by heart. One of the stories that made us aware of how old and important we were is the story of Amenhotep, the fourth pharaoh of the 18th Egyptian dynasty, known for having unified the Godhead, insisting that people worship only his favorite god, as it turned out, whose name was Aten, the sun, not just as a god, but as the god. So we were taught that Amenhotep, the fourth pharaoh of the 18th Egyptian dynasty, was the first Unitarian. To an 8-year-old, in 1959, to be related even tangentially to a pharaoh was incredibly cool. And to be related even tangentially to a mummy was cooler still. Particularly cool if you went to a church that nobody had ever heard of, whose religion was way too complicated to explain. As my faith matured and my understanding deepened, I made a powerful connection between those early understandings, the understandings the Beacon curriculum was intended to foster, and the naturalistic theism I was beginning to embrace. And 1959 marked the centennial of the publication of Darwin's masterpiece on the origin of the species. It's yet another synchronous indication of why I'm here today, that this morning in religious education, the children are studying evolution as a religious text. Very interesting. Now, to celebrate the occasion in 1959, the occasion of the centennial, the Blackfriars, a University of Chicago theater club, commissioned a musical comedy on the life and work of Charles Darwin. It was entitled Time Will Tell. Having already begun to grasp that evolution, as Darwin taught, expressed the will and ways of nature's God, I adored and memorized most of the show. It was also written by my uncle, which meant I was at a lot of rehearsals. I memorized in particular the duet between Fitzroy, the stalwart, upright, and very tradition-bound captain of the Beagle, and his brilliant, pensive, winsome ship's naturalist. Fitzroy, secure in his creationist worldview, sang this: I believe the species immutable, as is clearly proper and suitable. It can't be that nature's whim rules what flies, what crawls, what swims. I believe it's quite irrefutable that there is a power inscrutable, and that agency divine, with a certain hand, fashions sea and land according to a grand design. No. Please. There on the rolling deck, with the sailors listening in, Darwin counters. And those of you who are musicians can hear how these actually musically are designed to be sung together. But I've yet to be able to do that. I'm working on it. Darwin sings, what destroyed the once mighty mastodon? Why are seashells found far from shore? How can one explain why species wax and wane in seemingly insane, brutal war? While some became extinct, wait for it, others lasted on. Who determined which would survive? These riddles unresolved of how the world evolved will never cease to bother me as long as I'm alive. Believe the species immutable. Get it? It's wonderful. There it is, right there on the rolling deck of the Beagle, the change. It had been centuries in the making as the personified patriarchal image of God the Father, maker of heaven and earth, gave way to a far more nuanced and more demonstrable understanding of the process of creation and of the interdependent web of all existence some of us still have the audacity to call God. Darwin was by no means the first to recognize that interdependent, interrelated reality in nature. His intellectual mentor, and in many ways his hero, was a man named Alexander von Humboldt. How many of you have heard of Alexander von Humboldt? 4 or 5. Well, Alexander von Humboldt was a German naturalist and explorer whose work was shaped and informed by Goethe and Schiller and the circle known as the German idealists, the most famous of whom is Kant. Their work also undergirds the worldview of American Unitarianism and particularly of American Transcendentalism, that same group of German philosophers. But at the end of World War I, they were expunged from American curricula, as was all progressive German thought. When we went to war against the Germans, we decided, as we tend to do, that the Germans had nothing to offer us. and therefore we ignored the most significant liberal flowering of intellectual power the world has ever seen, and we don't know much about them. In her magnificent new biography of Humboldt, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World, Andrea Wolf, who is an historian of gardens, which is a very interesting thing. Her other major book is on the gardens of the founders and what their landscape design has to do with their philosophy of life and the forming of the nation. It's fascinating. Well, Andrea Wolf is her name, and she points to one particular moment when the understanding I'm describing today broke through. Von Humboldt and his team were making their way through the Andes with the intention of climbing Chimborazo. Now, this is 1810-ish. At 21,000 feet, the dormant volcano Chimborazo was then thought to be the tallest mountain in the world. After an hour of treacherous climbing, she writes, the ridge became a little less steep, but now sharp rocks tore their shoes and their feet began to bleed. Then suddenly the fog lifted, revealing Chimborazo's white peak glinting in the sun a little over 1,000 feet in front of them. But they also saw that the narrow ridge had ended. Instead, they were confronted by the mouth of a huge crevasse which opened up in front of them. To get around it would have involved walking across a field of deep snow. But by now it was 1 p.m. and the sun had melted the icy crust that covered the snow. When Montafar, one of Humboldt's companions, gingerly tried to tread on it, he sank so deeply he completely disappeared. There was no way to cross. As they paused, Humboldt took out his barometer again and measured their altitude at 19,413 feet. Though they wouldn't make it to the summit, it still felt like being on top of the world. No one had ever come this high, not even the early balloonists in Europe. She doesn't mention this, but I feel obligated to tell you that other people had been higher than that, but they weren't white and they weren't European, so it didn't really happen. But that's another sermon. Looking down on Chimborazo's slopes and the mountain ranges in the distance, everything that Humboldt had seen in the previous years came together. His brother Wilhelm had long believed that Alexander's mind was made, quote, to connect ideas, to detect the chains of things. As he stood that day on Chimborazo, Humboldt absorbed what lay in front of him while his mind reached back to all the plants, rock formations, and measurements he had seen and taken on the slopes of the Alps, the Pyrenees, and in Tenerife. Everything that he'd ever observed fell into place. Nature, Humboldt realized, was a web of life. He coined that phrase at that moment. Nature was a web of life and a global force. Nature was, a colleague later said, to Humboldt, about Humboldt rather, that Humboldt was the first to understand that everything was interwoven as with 1,000 threads. This new idea of nature was to change the way people understood the world. Humboldt was, in his day, said to be the second most famous man in the world, surpassed only by that little brute Napoleon. His work was central not only to Darwin's efforts, but then to the works of Henry Thoreau and John Muir and Rachel Carson and of every environmental activist who seeks to hold the whole world alive in their hands. Humboldt's far-reaching research, combined with the scope of his appreciation for poetic imagination, undergird the environmental movement we work to carry forth today. I'm pleased to report that an effort is underway at Unity Church in St. Paul in concert with five other Twin Cities Unitarian Universalist congregations that gives us a chance to take a step away from dependence on carbon-based energy. We have an opportunity to join the solar garden movement and show the nation a practical way to change life for the better. Does anyone know about solar gardens? Okay, one person. So I'm going to briefly digress and tell you about solar gardens. So what happens is a company buys land. They buy enough land to build a large array of solar cells. They then sell the energy from their solar array to the local power provider. What's the name here? Wisconsin Energy. Okay, so Wisconsin Energy buys solar power from a solar garden. You can contract through Wisconsin Energy to get exclusively power from the solar garden. You have to commit to it for a long time, 25 years in Minnesota, because they leverage that commitment to finance the garden. So that's how this works. It's quite interesting. It's just a gesture, but it is a healthy, positive gesture. My wife Jan and I intend to make this change, but even as we celebrate and seize the opportunity to purchase only solar power, we're aware that once again, the advantages of the new technology are available largely and in some ways exclusively to upper middle class people with high credit scores. And once again, we see that tragic and inappropriate divide between the work we need to do around disparities of race and class and the environmental movement, which really need to be linked powerfully. They need to be one movement. In order to participate in solar garden projects in Minnesota, one needs a credit score of 700 or more, a requirement that disqualifies a great many people, including the preponderance of Minnesotans of color. Even as those of us who qualify say yes to being among the pioneers of this new approach to spreading the availability of solar power, we also insist that Xcel and beyond Xcel, I suppose, Wisconsin Power, work closely with the major banks and with the regulatory agencies to implement unique financing tools that will allow low-income people to access the financing to pay for clean energy and energy efficiency improvements, which will lower their utility costs in Minnesota and across the nation, as well as engage the whole community, in weaning the world off carbon-based energy. We can't afford the split between the environmentalists and the racial justice community. We can't afford it. It's wrong-headed. And Unitarian Universalist congregations are notorious for debating which is more important, when in fact it is a false polarity. We live out our ministry at the intersection of spiritual development and social justice. Each morning we salute the sun. We greet the day and ask how best we might, in Wendell Berry's words, abandon arrogance and stand in awe. We must, he writes, recover our sense of the majesty of creation and the ability to be worshipful in its presence. Friends, you and I and all the friends and neighbors we have yet to know must, and I don't use that word often, but must awaken to the fact that we are truly partners in creation with all of the reverence, restraint, respect, and obligation such partnership implies. May it be so. And amen.